The harsh reality. Even after this exchange, I was not getting my point across. Mr. Adams still thought that with one single $425,000 purchase, his related financial responsibilities for housing Nate would be zero. I realized it was time for deployment of heavy reality weapons. Mr. Adams was not yet aware of the strong possibility that his son and daughter-in-law would probably need large and continuous doses of economic outpatient care, EOC. Mr. Adams couldn't appreciate the fact that it costs a great deal to sustain a household in a $425,000 neighborhood environment. It requires lots of money independent of mortgage payments. Do you have an idea about what the property taxes will be on a $425,000 home? Don't know. Well, it is somewhere between $7,600 and $8,000, but taxes there keep going up. The household takes home, net after income taxes, Social Security, and such, probably less than $35,000 of the $40,000 gross. So let's see, that is a minimum of $7,600 over $35,000, or about 22% of their income. With this revelation, I started making progress. I followed with a series of questions about other household expenses. I also illustrated several multiples to Mr. Adam. A $425,000 home is more than three times the current value of the average for a single-family home in America. On a national basis, people who purchase homes valued at $425,000 have incomes that are more than three times the average. How much are the homes of the wealthy people in America worth? This is not an easy question to answer with my survey data because most of it is geo-specific. I deliberately oversampled those neighborhoods with high concentrations of millionaires. Conversely, more than one-half of the neighborhoods in America are not surveyed. They contain no or low concentrations of millionaires, but there may be one millionaire in every 100 households. This is in sharp contrast with the geo-specific sample upon which most of this program is based. On average, more than 70 in 100 households surveyed were in the millionaire category. It's not surprising that these very affluent neighborhoods contain many expensive homes, but the same is not true on a national basis. Who has the most complete data on millionaires? Not yours truly. The answer is our own Internal Revenue Service. The IRS recently provided data that can be used to estimate the value of homes by various wealth groups. The beauty of this information is easy to appreciate. It includes all millionaires, not just those who live in exclusive residential areas, and contains all of them, from multimillionaire farmers in rural America, to wealthy scrap metal dealers from blue-collar neighborhoods, to very wealthy executives residing in exclusive neighborhoods filled with multimillion-dollar homes. My analysis of this data can be used as a great defensive weapon. What if your son and his wife are putting pressure on you to buy them an expensive home? They tell you everyone lives in homes valued at this amount. They also tell you that it's only a small portion of your wealth. Mr. Adam and others should answer with a simple fact, the same one I gave Mr. Adam. Most millionaires nationwide live in homes valued at much less than $425,000. And if the typical millionaire is comfortable living in a home like that, millionaires' less affluent sons and daughters-in-law should be too. According to the IRS database, which encompasses all millionaire households nationwide, and thus includes certain geodemographic categories not surveyed in my study, such as farmers and others, the average value of the American millionaire's home is estimated to be $277,640. Millionaires in the 2.5 to under $5 million net worth category live in homes worth $354,043 on average. Nate is proposing to live in a home that's more expensive than those owned by most millionaires. The defensive memo. There are hundreds of thousands of affluent parents in America today who have or will experience problems similar to Mr. Adams. What defense do they have against the pressure for EOC in the form of subsidized housing? Now they have a counter-argument. It could be given in oral or written form. Memorandum. To Nates and Nadettes. From Affluent Parents. Re. Your request for subsidized housing, i.e. a gift of a $425,000 home. Please reconsider your request that we buy you a $425,000 home. Along these lines, note the following. On average, the American millionaire has a net worth of just under $3 million. Yet he or she lives in a home that is valued at only $277,640. You are not a millionaire. So why is it necessary for you to live in a $425,000 home? Contrast $277,640 with $425,000 and you may see the light. You are proposing to live in a home that is 153.1% more valuable than the home of the typical millionaire. Note that, on average, the typical millionaire who lives in his or her $277,640 home has a total realized annual income of about $145,000. Your household's current annual income is about $40,000. That is about 27.6% of what millionaires earn on average. Perhaps you could use these numbers to determine the value of a home that would be more suitable given your current income. Why not consider a home valued at 27.6%, your income as a percent of a millionaire's, of the typical millionaire's, $277,640. This translates into roughly $77,000. There are some small starter homes within 20 or 30 miles of here that are in that price range. A home valued at this level is a good fit for someone in the $40,000 income bracket. If you insist on living in a more expensive home, we will only subsidize your purchase up to $77,000. You will have to pay the additional cost. Thus, you may wish to postpone your purchase until you have acquired more capital. Mr. Adams' case is not unusual. He is a dedicated father to Nate, and he is still in the denial stage. He still believes that once he hands over the $425,000 home, Nate will somehow be self-sufficient. But even with an income of twice what Nate and his wife currently earn, they would have difficulty supporting themselves. What will probably happen when Nate takes possession of his $425,000 home? He and his wife will require constant doses of EOC from Mr. Adam. Such subsidies can have a dampening effect on ambition and the development of a strong self-image. Yes, Mr. Adam still feels that his son will be more ambitious, more self-confident, if only. If only what? If only Nate could live in a neighborhood filled with ambitious, high-income achievers? But ambition and confidence are not contracted like a disease. Living near and around ambitious, high-income earners will not automatically transform Nate into a productive person. The full cost of accepting EOC. There are often strings attached to the EOC one accepts. A married couple in their mid-40s wanted to build a $570,000 home, but they were a bit short in terms of capital. So the husband asked his wealthy retired parents for a subsidy. They had lived in Ohio for most of their lives and had some interest in moving closer to their son and his family. Atlanta appealed to them, but they had never taken the step of shopping for a home in the area. Their prospects for moving to Atlanta brightened the day their son called and asked for a home subsidy. Without it, he could never afford to build his dream home. If you were his parents, how would you respond to his request? Sure, you may be worth several million dollars, but you are now retired. Your big income-earning years are behind you. You deserve to enjoy your remaining golden years without providing your adult, college-educated children with a few $100,000. How can you say no without hurting your son's feelings? Should you dare mention that you subsidized his last home purchase? The couple considered various responses, then hit on a sure winner. They told their son that they would provide the subsidy, but there was one condition. His architect would have to make some changes to the home plans. The parents suggested that the entire basement area be made into an apartment with two bedrooms, full kitchen, 1.5 baths, a den, wall-to-wall carpet, and full appliances. When they finally decided to move out of Ohio, they could just move in with their son and his family, rent-free. The move could even be sooner if one died or became disabled. What a great offer. The son would not only receive several $100,000, he would also get mom and dad. It's hard to believe that he turned down the deal. The lifestyles of millionaires, real versus imagined. Thoughts from a Connecticut Yankee millionaire. A joke that struck home, two friends were walking down a sidewalk when one looked up, saw Mr. Crane coming in the opposite direction. Quickly, he crossed the street. Then his friend asked, "Why are you avoiding Crane?" "Because he's a man who's living off his capital." Although few of us Yankees would shun friends for squandering capital, we certainly wouldn't be caught dead doing it ourselves. W.H.H., Ph.D. Contrast the philosophy of the Connecticut Yankee with Mr. R.R.P.'s. Mr. R.R.P., regional radio personality, is the ultimate consumer. He called me one day and asked if I would be interviewed, and I agreed. He was very persuasive and had a great telephone voice. His show was rated number 2 or 3 in the broadcast area. I wondered why he asked me to show up an hour before airtime, but I found out soon enough when I arrived. He said hello and then got down to his problem. His contract was up for renewal, and he had spent considerable time negotiating with the station's senior executive. He strongly believed that he'd save many dollars if he didn't hire an agent, so he was his own manager. Unfortunately, he wasn't represented by a skilled negotiator. Within 10 minutes, Mr. RRP told me his financial problems. At the time, he had more than $30,000 in credit card debt, which translates into over $7,000 in annual interest payments. This $30,000 balance wasn't unusual for him either. He'd had this kind of balance outstanding for many years, and often it was more than $30,000. But this was just the first stop on the Tell Me Your Story trip. Mr. RRP earns more than $100,000 annually, placing him in the top 7% of all income-producing individuals in America. What about his level of net worth? Would you suspect that this fellow in his late 30s would be worth several hundred thousand dollars? Actually, Mr. RRP has a negative net worth. How is this possible? Does he have a large family to support? Is he paying medical expenses for an elderly relative? Did he and his wife purchase an expensive home? Is Mr. RRP paying off all of his education loans? The answer to all of these and related questions is no. He is single, he rents his home, and he leases his automobiles. But that's not where all his money goes. And Mr. RRP is not alone. There are many others with the same lifestyle, and they all have one thing in common. They believe that one must spend a lot of money to enjoy life. Mr. RRP is a hyperspender. It's in his mind and in his habits. He believes that buying certain products and services has a direct influence on one's happiness. Mr. RRP and his group all want to be happy and enjoy life, but there's a problem. He can only do this if his income increases. How should Mr. RRP approach the issue of compensation needs with the senior executive? You probably have an answer that is very different from the strategy he employed. Mr. RRP told his boss what I just outlined, that he was in debt and was unable to make ends meet. But he told him a lot more. Mr. RRP was becoming progressively more worried about the prospect of not being happy. And the only way to be happy is to spend your way into enjoyment world. If you were Mr. RRP's boss, how would you respond to this theme? Your employee needs more money because he's broke. Perhaps, as his boss, you'd be more responsive to a theme based on increases in his productivity, but that wasn't part of Mr. RRP's negotiating theme. Should Mr. RRP's boss give him a raise? It all goes back to basic needs. Mr. RRP needs a job, and he has less than zero wealth. He is at the mercy of his employer, not the other way around. It makes no difference that Mr. RRP owns a dozen watches, 2 expensive automobiles, has bar tabs at the top singles bars in town, dines at fine restaurants, and has every conceivable type of recreational equipment. He has no wealth. He is at the economic razor's edge. He cannot live for more than a month or two without a paycheck. This is all bad enough by itself, but Mr. RRP went one step beyond in telling his boss about his economic situation. You probably wouldn't give this guy a raise. Even worse, you might start looking to replace Mr. RRP because you may believe that any key employee who is possessed by possessions and consumption cannot be productive. Having a negative net worth can be very distracting and often has a dampening effect on job performance. This is an unfortunate situation for Mr. RRP. He forgot something about life. One does not have to buy products and services in order to get a lot out of it. Mr. RRP's lifestyle is one of shopping and consuming. To him, it's impossible to enjoy the summer without having a jet ski or two, perhaps on credit. How can he have fun without spending a few hours downing Premier Label Scotch at $7 a hit at a trendy bar? Mr. RRP is overspent, overfed, overdressed, overliquored, overtraveled, overentertained, and overindulgent in general. It seems that everything he does outside of working and sleeping costs a lot of money. His focus is Mr. RRP and Mr. RRP's problems, and he believes he can spend his way into the club of happiness. Mr. RRP's lifestyle is very different from the activities and interests of most millionaires. He thinks millionaires are even more indulgent than he is, but he's completely wrong. Moderation in consumption and a healthy, disciplined lifestyle are the hallmarks of the affluent in America. Are your lifestyle habits congruent with becoming more and more productive? For most people with the millionaire mind, the answer is yes. For Mr. RRP, the answer is no. Keep Mr. RRP and his lifestyle in mind as you review the activities and interests of millionaires discussed in this section. Real versus imagined. Let's review the lifestyle activities that 733 millionaires engaged in during the past month. Before you absorb this information, picture in your mind the typical millionaire. Do you think he's very different in his lifestyle from most people? Remember that the millionaires described in this program are among the most productive business owners, senior corporate executives, physicians, and attorneys in America. They also live in many of the better quality neighborhoods. Their homes, on average, are worth $1.4 million. They are well-educated. About 90% are college graduates. They have an average annual realized income of over $600,000 and a net worth in the high seven figures. Outside of working, what do these people do with their time? If you think that all millionaires are workaholics, you're wrong. Most have a well-balanced style of life, and their activities and interests are not as flashy as Hollywood movie producers and writers in the popular press would have us believe. Would you expect that attending religious services is too common an activity for self-made millionaires? Surely these people only believe in themselves and their ability to generate high levels of income and wealth. Wrong. Maybe you expect that these millionaires would be more likely found shopping at Brooks Brothers or Saks than eating at Burger King or McDonald's. Try again. Keep one thing in mind. Millionaires are extraordinarily successful at producing high incomes and accumulating wealth. Activities that directly relate to these goals, like planning investments and consulting with advisors, normally make up a large part of their activity lists. In many other aspects of their lifestyle activities, millionaires are anything but extraordinary. They have a few habits that set them apart from most of us. The proof is in the data. When people ask me about the lifestyles of millionaires, I have a short answer. The typical millionaire is, in three words, a cheap date. What activity ranks first in the lifestyle activities of millionaires? Socializing with your children and/or grandchildren. Friends versus things. Family interaction is ranked first. Second on the activity scale is entertaining close friends. Remember how much fun you had as a child with your close friends? It didn't cost much to play in the dirt or on the swings with your friends. Millionaires don't spend much to entertain close friends either. How much does it cost to play bridge or have a few friends over for dinner? Not a great deal. It's the interaction with people you care about that's most important. Too many young people feel that real fun has a dollar cost built into the equation. Fun has become a marketing tool for many consumer goods and services. Do you really need to buy a $50,000 boat so you can hang out with your best friend? Can you live for just one more day without a jet ski? If you don't have one, who'd want to be your friend? Is fun only experienced by spending a small fortune at Disney World? Will you fail to make new friends and keep old ones if you don't own a mountain ski lodge? Good friends like you and want to be with you for reasons other than the consumer goods you own. It's important for America's youth to discover that millionaires, even most deca-millionaires, don't depend on consumer goods to enjoy life. Their pleasures and self-satisfaction have more to do with their families, friends, religion, financial independence, physical fitness, and perhaps a bit of golf. Look at it the other way. There is nothing more pitiful than a person who has no close friends, no loving family, yet owns millions of dollars of consumer goods. People like that are a very small segment of the millionaire population. In fact, there is a strong positive correlation between the number of people-related lifestyle activities one engages in and the level of one's net worth. It's just as a multimillionaire once told me. He coached his daughter's softball team for several years, and although it was not premeditated, he met many successful parents who were business owners. Some of these people ultimately became his clients. It doesn't matter if you're marketing commercial real estate or legal services. It helps to be active, to interact with other successful people. Many jokes have been written about the high propensity of successful people to play golf and hang out at the country club playing tennis. Many wealthy people do play golf and tennis. As a side note, there is a rather strong positive correlation between one's level of wealth and playing golf. Deca-millionaires are nearly twice as likely to play golf than high-incoming producing non-millionaires. Golf is important to many millionaires. How does its importance stack up against watching their children play sports? Golf comes in second. Even during the prime golf season, only 45% of the millionaires indicated that they played golf in the past month. Golf ranks 13th overall. Contrast this with another sports-related event. Fully 61% of the millionaires indicated watching your children or grandchildren play sports. A larger percentage of millionaires watched their children play sports, 61%, then played golf, 45%, or tennis, 23%. The significance of watching children play sports is more than their love for the children. About one-half the millionaires surveyed played competitive sports at some time in their lives, even if it was only JV football or freshman softball in high school. Most of the participants believe they benefited from playing competitive sports. A certain competitive nature may have been enhanced as a result. They learned about the importance of teamwork through these experiences. There is an additional benefit. The data indicate that people who played sports in school exercise more often during their adult years. The health and psychological benefits of regular exercise are well documented. Most affluent parents encourage their children to participate in sports. They believe that it's part of becoming a well-rounded individual, and they spend time watching them play. This doesn't mean that millionaire parents are superior to others or that they love their kids more. It's a matter of the discretion people have over their time and about priorities. There is a strong positive correlation between one's level of net worth and the frequency with which they watch their children play sports. How can it be possible? The hallmark of being wealthy is having control over how you allocate your time. Data from my national surveys indicates this relationship is a strong one indeed. Therefore, it's not surprising that the turnout of parents at after-school athletic events is greater in affluent areas as opposed to blue-collar districts, because the affluent have more discretion over their time than the non-affluent. Since most millionaires are self-employed business owners or professionals, they make their own schedules. Even senior executives employed by public corporations have much discretion over their time. They are given a task, and how they complete it is up to them. For blue-collar workers on an assembly line or driving a truck during game time, work takes priority. The major difference between millionaires and those of average wealth is how they are compensated. Millionaires are usually paid according to performance and results, while most others are paid by the hour, pieces produced, or some other specific constraints on their time and motion. In sharp contrast, economic success is a direct function of being able to define one's own allocation of time and motion. Cheap date. Since you can't be in two places at one time, if you're watching your kids play ball, you can't be shopping at Brooks Brothers or Saks. If you're socializing with your children, even just playing catch in the backyard, you can't be putting money in a slot machine at a casino. This is all part of the cheap date concept. In a comparison of cheap date activities versus costly activities, the cheap date activities outpace the ones that cost dollars. It's actually more than an issue of costs. Many cheap date activities actually enhance one's productivity. Also, nearly one-half of the millionaires, 47%, engaged in prayer. It doesn't cost much to consult with God. And for a significant percentage of millionaires, their religious faith is a major force in their lives. It's also an important factor that actually underlies their economic and spiritual success, as detailed in the earlier section, The Relationship Between Courage and Wealth. There are several other dimensions to the cheap date concept. Most millionaires are not the do-it-yourself types, especially when a task takes more than a few hours to complete. They know that time is money. The typical millionaire earns more than $320 per hour from his or her main vocation. If they need a shelf installed, it may take an hour just to saw, sand, and finish, not to mention the additional time to shop for wood. Then it takes more time to install it. If it ultimately requires 3 or 4 hours to install a $10 piece of wood on a wall, that shelf actually costs between $1,050 and $1,400 in lost opportunity. It's not only economics that dictates the millionaire's aversion to do-it-yourself tasks. What's the number one substitute for do-it-yourself activities? For millionaires, it's playing golf. There's a very strong negative correlation between the time spent playing golf and do-it-yourself activities. Golf can be expensive, considering the cost of club membership, greens fees, equipment, and clothing. But millionaires justify the expenses and opportunity costs associated with playing golf. It's not golf. The real game on the fairway is cultivating new customers and keeping current ones happy. Golf ranks 13th on the activity scale, well below planning investments at number 3. Planning investments is an individual sport, and no special equipment is needed. Just ask all the millionaires I bump into at the library. I'm there doing research for my books, and they're there waiting in line to review the latest Value Line and Standard & Poor reports. It doesn't cost a penny to get into the library, and you don't even need a library card to gain access to many of the finest investment research vehicles. A 12-month diary. There is some benefit to studying lifestyle activities in terms of a 12-month period because then we can include annual activities like vacations and preparing personal income tax returns. Most of these lifestyle activities are very different from the lavish lifestyles that people imagine. Those are more common among non-millionaires with high incomes than among first-generation millionaires. This same pseudo-affluent lifestyle among the non-millionaires in America explains why most high-living people never become wealthy. When the term millionaire is mentioned, most Americans have visions of a highbrow, high-consumption lifestyle. Ask the general population about the activities and interests of millionaires on an annual basis. Which of the following do you think would rank high? Skiing in the Rockies? Skiing in the Alps? Sailing on a yacht? Gambling at casinos? Taking an ocean cruise around the world? Vacationing in Palm Springs? Attending a Grand Slam tennis tournament? Vacationing in Paris? If you guessed any of these activities, you'd be wrong. They all rank in the bottom half on the frequency scale. The number one activity is consulting with a tax expert. Is this your vision of millionaires and multimillionaires in America? Why do so many millionaires participate in this activity? It may have something to do with the fact that the typical millionaire in this study paid more than $300,000 in taxes on last year's income. Nearly 1 in 5 paid more than $1 million. The rich pay a lot more than their fair share of taxes in this country. Those with annual realized incomes of $1 million or more make up less than 0.1% of the households in America, but they account for about 14.7% of all the income tax collected. Obviously, most millionaires see the benefit of consulting with tax experts. Even a 5% or 10% reduction in taxes is the equivalent of paying for all or a big part of their child's college tuition. Note something else related to income tax. Only 30% of the millionaires surveyed prepare their own taxes, and 1/3 of these are CPAs or tax attorneys. There's a pattern here that's interesting. There's a very strong, statistically significant, negative correlation between the do-it-yourself activities listed and wealth. In rank order, according to the degree of significance, these include mowing your own lawn, do-it-yourself plumbing, preparing your own taxes, painting your home's exterior. Those with lower levels of accumulated wealth have a higher tendency to do all or most of these activities. In sharp contrast, there is a strong correlation between one's level of wealth and hiring a professional to do one's taxes. Perhaps multimillionaires once did many do-it-yourself tasks prior to becoming decamillionaires. As a rule, this is not the case, nor does age account for much of the variation in do-it-yourself activity among the high-income or high-net-worth groups. In fact, there is strong evidence that do-it-yourself activities are substitutes to building wealth. Actually, you are not the first to hear these results. I told my wife about this relationship just moments after examining the computer output. She was not moved by the empirical data. Millionaires not doing things around the home, what do they do with their spare time? They are involved in activities that enhance their wealth. Enlighten me after you take out the beagle. The most significant substitute. Of the 30 lifestyle activities listed in the 12-month diary, one stands out as having the most significant inverse relationship with net worth. Playing the lottery. The higher a person's net worth, the less likely he is to ever play the lottery. Outside the office. What high-income producing young person today will probably become tomorrow's millionaire? One who works hard and selects an ideal vocation. But if this person plans to enhance his net worth in the future, he must become involved in certain outside activities. First, work closely with tax advisors and tax-advantaged investment consultants. Then become active in your community. There is no more noble lifestyle activity than raising funds for charity. Note that nearly two-thirds of the millionaires, 64%, engaged in this activity in the past 12 months. And there was a very strong positive correlation between this activity and net worth. Some may contend that fundraising is an activity for those who are already very rich, the seniors of the affluent population. Or they suggest that raising funds for charity is an activity dominated by people who inherited their wealth. In fact, volunteering time to raise funds for charity is not significantly related to age or inherited wealth, and it's not dominated by older multimillionaires. Nor is it purely the domain of those who are already wealthy. Most of today's millionaires were raising funds for good causes before they became financially independent, and most did it because of noble intent. Good deeds do get rewarded even here on earth. Financially successful people and the next generation of economically productive people volunteer. When they cluster in various fundraising situations, they get to know and appreciate each other. People are always seen at their best when involved in noble causes, and their reputation and integrity are, in turn, enhanced. Over the years of studying successful people, I have discovered a simple rule. If you wish to become affluent, associate with economically productive people. Art, entertainment, and travel. Outside of fundraising, are there other lifestyle activities related to one's level of wealth? The more wealth one accumulates, the more likely one is to engage in art, entertainment, and travel activities. 57% of the millionaires took overseas vacations during the past year. But decamillionaires are even more prone to international travel. 7 out of 10 engaged in this activity. Does this disprove the theory that millionaires only spend money in ways that enhance their wealth? It's logical to assume that vacations are for pleasure, not for business, investment purposes, or tax-advantage expenditures. But for many millionaires, a vacation, especially overseas, can and often does enhance their net worth. Consider the physician who is self-employed. Last year, he had a net income of nearly $1 million. Dr. Edwards is an outstanding physician in part because he constantly keeps up with changes and innovations in medicine. He also writes and publishes articles related to his own work, and he is often asked to present research papers at regional, national, and international medical conventions. There are many conventions and opportunities for Dr. Edwards to lecture. He usually has several letters on his desk from different associations that want him to make a presentation at their meetings. Some even offer a modest stipend of $1,000 and pay for his lodging. He has many frequent flyer miles built up from all those trips taken in the past, enough to fly his whole family for free anywhere in the world. Given the choice of Chicago in February or Paris in May, it's no wonder that Dr. Edwards takes frequent overseas vacations. He can kill two birds with one stone. He can give his presentation, in part a cost of doing business, and he and his wife can do what about one half of the other overseas-bound millionaires do. Go to Europe to purchase or invest in original art and attend antique auctions. Dr. Edwards' case is typical among multimillionaires. Only a minority of multimillionaires travel overseas for the sole purpose of vacationing. For most, there is some other issue at hand, usually a mix of business, investing, and pleasure, but not necessarily in that order. There are certain tax advantages of blending business with pleasure, but before you plan your travel overseas with tax and business benefits in mind, consult a CPA or tax attorney. There are many gray areas about blending business, pleasure, and investments in art and antiques. In general, productive people have more opportunities to accomplish this blending, and they often have their vacations subsidized. In Search of the Millionaires. Imagine you are a young, inexperienced market researcher who had been assigned to interview millionaires. You had a large expense account that enabled you to travel all over the world, and you found some millionaires in the places you looked. Your boss was not completely satisfied with your work. You've reported that you found millionaires vacationing in Paris, but your boss referred you to my data showing that only 20% were vacationing in Paris last year. Then he asked if you'd visited any of the tax consultants that millionaires patronize. You didn't think of this angle because, like most people, you envision wealthy people at play on expensive vacations. You never thought of them sitting in an advisor's office working on their tax situations, but they are more than four times as likely to be found there than vacationing in Paris. So your boss was not at all pleased with your efforts to find millionaires who were skiing in the Alps. Only 4 in 100 did that last year. There were a lot of millionaires on that ocean cruise you took last year, but they were not a representative sample. Only 3 millionaires in 100 were aboard such cruises. Your boss suggested strongly that you find another line of work. In fact, you're in the process of being replaced. Your boss just hired a young woman who is very active in raising funds for charities. Ellen persuaded your boss to hire her because she claims that most millionaires are active in raising funds for noble causes, and she already works with many of them. Ellen is correct in her assertion that extravagant consumption is out and fundraising is in among millionaires. Fundraising outpaces vacationing in Paris 3-1, skiing in the Alps 16-1, attending a Grand Slam tennis tournament 6-1, sailing on a yacht 3-1, and taking an ocean cruise around the world 21-1. A wake-up call. Is it true that the early bird catches the worm? Perhaps, but people are not robins. If becoming a millionaire was a direct function of getting up earlier than others, many school bus drivers and milkmen would be rich. Most are not millionaires. It would be too easy. Look at it another way. There are no sure things about becoming wealthy. Certain significant factors can explain variations in wealth, and probability statements can be made, but it's not possible to say with 100% certainty that John Smith or Jane Doe will become millionaires if they wake up early in the morning. At one time I did believe what my folks taught me, that waking up earlier than others would enhance my income and ultimately my net worth. Way back when, I spent many weekend hours caddying. During my first year, the caddy master had a problem. Several senior caddies complained that the caddy master was playing favorites. They told some important people at the club about the political nature of allocating caddy assignments. I'm not sure that there was a political agenda, but the caddy master was on the hot spot. Frankly, I was not much concerned. I was the youngest and least experienced 12-year-old in the caddy stable, so I was always given the bags of two guys who never tipped. I always ended up with Bob and Andy Ancient, or some of their relatives. They were typically in their late 80s or 90s. Not only did I have to carry their bags, I also had to carry their folding seats. As a rule, it took the Ancient brothers 6 to 8 hours to play 18 holes of golf, including their 90-minute lunch. Even with many mulligans, these so-called golfers never broke 110. But the Ancient brothers' act never really bothered me. I was the lowest caddy on the experience scale, and they were multimillionaires, household names in American industry. So I suspect they thought I was overpaid. But some of the older caddies hated to work for these guys. Some felt the caddy master gave the really good tippers to his relatives and to friends of his sons. To solve this problem, the club agreed to an objective method of assigning work, the first-in, first-out method. The caddy who arrived first each morning would be assigned to the first twosome or foursome. How simple. How very democratic. Yet how unproductive. The system didn't last very long. The better and more competitive golfers were the first to protest. In the past, they always got the best, most experienced caddies to work for them. They insisted on it. And they often employed the same caddies each time they played golf. More often than not, they were very generous in allocating tips according to the performance of the fellows who carried their bags. But there is more to being a caddy than carrying a bag. A good caddy is an instructor, consultant, coach, and motivator all in one. When the best players were hooked up with caddies who lacked these qualities, they got angry. They hated the first-in, first-out system. In a way, this is analogous to building wealth in America. The more productive people, whether they be caddies or attorneys, earn more than less productive ones. Just because an attorney shows up earlier than others at a court proceeding does not ensure that he'll win the case. At any rate, the caddy system based on arrival time failed big time. On the first Saturday it was introduced, I arrived at the caddy station at 7 a.m. The place was already filled with caddies. So the following Saturday, I woke up at 4 a.m. and pedaled my bike through beautiful Westchester County to the club, arriving before 5:30 a.m. But I still wasn't first in line. There were five or six fellows already standing in front of the caddy house. The really early arrivals were sleeping on the men's room floor. They had been there since about 11 p.m. the night before. How could anyone win this contest? Was this the most productive use of anyone's time and energy? It's the same answer in regard to accumulating wealth. People who are self-made millionaires had to figure out a way to become financially independent. They selected a vocation that rewarded them for being productive during the hours that they work. In essence, it's not what time people start their workday or get up in the morning that makes them financially successful. It's how productive they are during the working hours that counts. Are the best prepared, most knowledgeable, most productive teachers and professors paid more than the less productive ones? Not usually. Only in the most competitive colleges and universities are the most productive faculty members rewarded for their superior performances. In other schools, it's just a matter of how many hours, days, years a professor has been a member of the faculty. A first-in mentality is not tolerated by ambitious and productive people. Seniority should only be relevant when objective performance measures are given most of the weight in allocating economic resources. Without such incentives, the productive people will move on or become less productive. Those who remain are the people who watch clocks and calendars. So what if they were hired first, yet produce little? What does this have to do with becoming wealthy in America? If you work in an environment that rewards performance, you will probably be motivated through economic opportunities to perform at a high level. Getting up earlier than others isn't difficult. It does not take a great deal of intelligence. But being first is important in another regard. If you are the first to come up with an innovative product, you'll probably beat out all of those who get up earlier than you because they place greater importance on arriving early than on developing a creative product. So let all those who want to offer me-too products and services wake up before dawn. Working 12-hour days may be a requirement to just getting by in a cutthroat industry. Keep one thing in mind about the first-in mentality, the system that is so pervasive in the civil service sector of our economy. Very few millionaires are civil servants. And they have a completely different orientation. They want to be compensated on the basis of performance. They do not want it any other way. They would never be able to motivate themselves if they worked in an environment where the first to arrive or the first to be hired was automatically given the lion's share of the economic resources. In terms of millionaires and high-income producing non-millionaires, there is no statistically significant correlation between the time one wakes up in the morning and one's wealth. The typical millionaire wakes up each workday about 6:40 a.m. The median figure is approximately 6:25 a.m. Only about 1 in 5 rises before 5:40 a.m. I used to wake up much earlier. I also used to write for 8 or 10 hours a day when I wasn't teaching. But I discovered that my books and papers were completed faster when I wrote for just 3 or 4 hours per day. Ultimately, it's the quality of the writing, not 10-hour days, that produces a best-selling book. If a writer's brain, the idea generator, shuts down after 3 or 4 hours of writing, the result of 6-hour writing days may be pure junkola. How often have you heard about the hard-charging entrepreneurs who awaken at 3 a.m. each day? So much for common knowledge. There is no statistically significant difference among millionaires in various occupational groups in regard to the time that they wake up each workday. Senior corporate executives wake up a bit earlier, on average, than others, but this is not a significant difference. Ode to Dr. Bill. One of my mentors was Dr. Bill Darden, a leading authority on lifestyle research. His office was directly across from mine while I was in graduate school. At that time, Bill was an associate professor. I noticed that he arrived each day in the mid or late morning hours. His door was always open while he was there. Bill was very kind to graduate students who sought his advice. He gave a lot of his time to those who asked for it. When, then, did Bill do all his research and writing? I found out early one morning. I entered the computer center at about 2 a.m. one day to run some very large programs that required a lot of computer time and thus were relegated to the late-night shift. Not too many people were there, but Bill was running his programs. He told me that most early mornings he was working, writing programs and crunching numbers. He had no graduate assistant who could do these things for him. My fellow graduate students thought that Dr. Bill Darden started his day at 10 or 11 a.m., but they were at least half wrong. Bill actually had two workday mornings. The first began around 1 a.m. and lasted until his programs ran. He went to bed at 3 a.m. Then he was up at 9 a.m. and arrived at the office between 10 and 11 a.m. At most top universities and colleges, faculty members work long and hard, but you may not see many of them in their offices at 8 each morning. They work when they want to work and make their own hours. So it is with many affluent and productive people. If you could control your workday and make your own schedule, perhaps you would decide that the 8-to-5 mandate doesn't fit your style. As long as you are productive, it matters little that you are crunching numbers at 2:30 a.m. or at 10 a.m. But don't try this if your employer stipulates that you must be at your desk from 8 to 5. Why do the Dr. Bill Dardens of the world sometimes work better at 2:30 a.m. than at 9 a.m.? He discovered that the computer center was always too crowded, too distracting during normal office hours. He became a distinguished professor in part because his ideas were published in top academic journals. The people who judged his work never asked if the author worked from 8 to 5 or from 2 to 9. They looked at the finished product. Not everybody is at their mental and physical best from 8 to 5. Bill told me that his best, most productive work and ideas usually showed up before dawn. That's when most other people were asleep. When are you most productive? Does this time coincide with your scheduled work time? If not, consider changing your schedule. And it's much easier to do that when you are your own scheduler. A final note about the millionaire mind. What do most millionaires tell me they learned in their salad years? They learned to think differently from the crowd. Much of this program has been designed around a central theme. It pays to be different. I have never been interested in studying what one of my respondents calls the beautiful people. He described them as people who seem destined to succeed in life. They supposedly have extremely high IQs, received all A's in grades pre-K through law school, medical school, graduate school, or other school, have graduated with top honors from the best schools and colleges in America, possess great looks, are tall with blue eyes, were Division I All-Americans in 4 varsity sports, trace their ancestors and trust accounts back to the Battle of Hastings in 1066, never break a sweat yet earn millions of dollars each year, play par golf, are on every board of every noble cause, have no cavities or physical ailments whatsoever, have had 5 adoring wives or husbands, all of whom were supermodels, and so on, and so on. Why do I have no interest in beautiful people? I have never met one millionaire who had all these qualities. Yet most non-millionaires think that these so-called beautiful people make up the bulk of the millionaire population in America. But I am still searching. I am most interested, however, in people like Paul Rossman, the fighter pilot ace with an injured arm. You will recall from earlier in the program that he compensated for his deficiency. He adjusted to his problem. Actually, his lack of one normally key attribute was the catalyst for his change in strategy. He was an ace because he tapped his creative sense. He found a better way to defeat competitors who were, in the context of fighter pilots, beautiful people. They were physical perfection. Physical perfection may be important in dogfights, but Rossman avoided such contests. He won because he selected the target, the time, the place, the altitude, the angle of attack. He was proactive. I have to wonder how many of the beautiful people whom he shot down realized that their opponent had only one good arm. Rossman was also the mentor to the ace of aces, the holder of the world's record for in-air victories, Eric Hartman. Whom do you want for a mentor? I want someone who is not a beautiful person. I want to learn about how to become economically productive from those who had one or more imperfections. They are the ones who figured out how to win. Most of these aces of economic productivity have few of the characteristics of beautiful people. Interestingly, many of my respondents have told me that if they were beautiful, partly beautiful, or totally beautiful, they would never have become so productive. Why not? Because they would never have had the need to be so very careful in selecting the ideal vocation, vocation, vocation. Consider the following case example. You decide if Donald and Winifred Sonner are beautiful people. Or perhaps they have a bit of Paul Rossman in them. A profile of Donald and Winifred Sonner, Southern Bloomer Manufacturing Company. The way Donald Sonner tells it, he has never really had a job in his life, at least not working for anyone else. The 64-year-old head of Southern Bloomer Manufacturing Company in Bristol, Tennessee, says he has been up and down the ladder many times since he became a millionaire for the first time when he was 24. What led him to work for himself? And how did he come up with the idea of manufacturing underwear for prisons and patches for guns? All out of scrap cloth? As a very young man on a farm, we worked awful hard, he remembers. In those days, we had to get our mail from a post office that was in a country store, and I would go to the store for the mail. While I was in the store many times, these peddlers would come through selling gloves, pipes, socks, that type of thing. Whenever the man who ran the store would pay them, they'd stick it on a big roll in their pocket. They always had a big roll of money, and coming from a farm, we'd never seen money. These guys had more money than God. When I was 15, I had an old pickup truck. I went to North Carolina to buy socks. I'd sold 2 heifer calves, and I was looking for the socks cheap. When I came back, I realized I'd bought seconds and couldn't sell them to the stores. So I went to sawmill camps and sold my socks. Finally, I sold them all and made a pretty good profit. Next time I went and bought more, but I knew more what I was looking for. Since that experience, Mr. Sonner has made, and sometimes lost, his fortune by divining perhaps unusual markets for his less-than-top-quality goods. I'm in the junk business. I'm the guy that buys the seconds, the odd lot cloth, out of textile mills. I'm their dumpster man, and I've developed a business that will consume those goods. What makes a business like mine function is the fact that we have the capital to take the cloth whether we're moving it or not, like a used auto parts place with car parts. We try to sell off everything we can, and the last resort is we turn them into rags and sell them to industries. For example, the Sonners have almost cornered the market for gun cleaning patches, which he makes from the scrap gathered from the cutting room and even the sewing room floor after he's made his garments, also, of course, made from imperfect cloth. He says of the gun patch business, "At first I was laughed at. People said he can't last long. But this was money from heaven. I had an endless supply. And it has grown into a substantial business for us." Sawmills for second quality socks. The military for gun patches. In between these markets, he built Southern Bloomer on another market most folks wouldn't have thought of. Prisons and mental institutions for his second-quality garments. He began making underpants for prisoners after he had lost all his fortune. His choice of market meant he didn't have to have uniform first-quality goods, so he could start with a smaller operation. There was a mental institution up the road, and I said they got women there. They needed an item that would go through their big, heavy steam laundry. By buying this odd lot cloth, I could give them a lot for their money. And with this little operation, I could put a lot of sewing into it. When you have something to sell, you gotta learn where there's a market. In today's apparel market, where the big chains have erased the old market of thousands of smaller stores, a smaller business must be more creative, he says, and develop ideas that do not require much capital. Mr. Sonner's wife Winifred runs the business with him, and he says she is a great partner, spearheading marketing and allowing him to handle manufacturing. She's a gorgeous woman, but she's gorgeous in the inside, too, Mr. Sonner says, and willing to fight to win. In business, you have to sacrifice a lot. My first wife was a little country girl from the mountains. As a young man, I made an awful lot of money selling women's apparel. As we made money, it became very important to her, to the point where she was rotten with it. Money affects some people differently. Winifred and I are comfortable with each other regardless of where we are. We make a tremendous team. I don't know who's the boss, but there's a kind of magic between us. So what is important in business and life? Loving your job, the money, having a good education? Mr. Sonner says, you have to like what you're doing, like a rabbit dog. You chase this rabbit and forget about everything else but catching the rabbit. You have to live it, but you get enjoyment out of some success in it. I do not have a great education, just a year of high school. You develop a feel for ideas that don't take much money. I don't think educational background in most cases is as important as the will to win. Making money while watching his costs was a hard-learned lesson for Mr. Sonner, and one he would recommend to young people who want to go into business for themselves. A lot of people I don't have anything in common with, they talk about their payments. I wouldn't have anything I had a payment on for anything in this world. Borrowed money has been my downfall. Today, I wouldn't borrow a dime. A self-made person is not a person generally who's trying to impress someone. I could drive any car I want. But I drive an 88 model minivan. It's in good shape. I bought it used in 90 for $5,000. I drive an 82 Volvo. It's clean. It's a nice car. I think I paid $3,000 for it. You got to do one of two things. Either have a master's degree in a good field, or work like hell and use your mind to start something small. Borrowing too much money ranks high on his list of bad business ideas. Borrowing a lot of money for a new business is the worst thing in the world. If you don't have any money, you learn how to do things without. If you have money, you make mistakes. The more money, the bigger the mistakes. You're paying interest 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you don't have any banks breathing down your throat, maybe you don't do as much. But it doesn't take so much to feed them. Another common downfall of startup ventures is too much inventory, he says. Inventory is the death of a lot of small businesses. I always thought the produce business was good because you either sell it or you smell it, so you learn to make it move. And you have to sacrifice. You learn to do with less, and in turn you grow the business. That's the reason second and third generation kids can't keep their parents' business growing. Their parents watched out for the pitfalls, and the kids don't have that experience. The eight parts. The case of Donald and Winifred Sonner is a true-to-life pro forma of economic success. It details the importance of hard work, focus, courage, not following the crowd with Me Too product offerings, and choice of spouse. The American economy rewards those who are of the millionaire mind. So keep in mind the eight important elements of the economic success equation. 1. Understand the key success factors our economy continues and will continue to reward. Hard work, integrity, and focus. 2. Never allow a lackluster academic record to stand in the way of becoming economically productive. 3. Have the courage to take some financial risk and learn how to overcome defeat. 4. Select a vocation that is not only unique and profitable, pick one you love. 5. Be careful in selecting a spouse. Those who are economically productive married husbands or wives who had the characteristics that are compatible with success. 6. Operate an economically productive household. Many millionaires prefer to repair or refinish rather than buy new. 7. Follow the lead of millionaires when selecting a home. Study, search, and negotiate aggressively. 8. Adopt a balanced lifestyle. Many millionaires are cheap dates. It does not take a lot of money to enjoy the company of your family and friends.
The Millionaire Mind was written by Dr. Thomas Stanley and read by Cotter Smith. The recording engineers were Paul Fowley and Michael Jones, with editing and post-production by Lisa Bainey. The mix engineer was Rick Bradley. The associate producer was Jessica Cassidy. The directors were Karen Perlman and Sally Hurst. The Millionaire Mind was produced by Sally Hurst. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.